It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. Ben Thompson from Stratechery joins Dan Gilmore and me as we talk about the week's tech news, those big layoffs at Microsoft, revelations about the security of the iPhone, even iOS 7, and why Netflix seems to have all wrong about me. Honest, it's wrong. It's all coming up next on Twit.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 467, recorded July 20th, 2014. Netflix thinks I'm a brony. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Citrix GoToMeeting, the powerfully simple way to meet with coworkers and clients from anywhere. Share the same screen and see each other face-to-face with HD video conferencing, even present from an iPad. Start your 30-day free trial of GoToMeeting today. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use the promo code TWIT. And by Jira, an Atlassian product. Jira is the project management solution for teams planning, building, and launching great products. To learn more about Jira and try it free for 30 days, visit Atlassian.com/TWIT. And by Audible.com. Sign up for the Platinum Plan and get 2 free books. Visit Audible.com/TWIT2. And don't forget to follow Audible on Twitter. User ID Audible_com. And by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For free 2-week trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code TWIT. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news in obsessive detail and usually have a little bit of fun doing it. So glad you're here and glad to have our guests on. Dan Gilmore, journalist, raconteur, DanGilmore.com. You'll see his columns in The Guardian as well as elsewhere. He also teaches right now at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication, where he tries to beat digital media literacy into the heads of the students at the Arizona State University. How's that going
good
for
to be
you?
Be with you.
How's that going?
Good.
And promoting
still
entrepreneurship.
Trying to figure it out.
I think promoting entrepreneurship is probably an easier thing to do with young people today. I think they realize that if they don't make a job, they're not going to have a job in many cases.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us, Dan. We appreciate it. Also here from Stratechery, one of the most insightful analysts. I'm quoting him all the time on the scene today. Ben Thompson, good to have you, Ben. Welcome.
Good to be here.
Monk Bent on Twitter. Is there a beat?
That's me.
Is there a beat for Stratechery? I know you do a paid newsletter. That's kind of your bread and butter. But you're not aiming at investors or anything like that particularly, are you?
I do think it's a great, great service for investors because it gives a lot of context to what's happening, but I don't give specific buy-sell advice or anything like that, So which does limit how much I can charge as well. the way I think about it is I've been doing Stratechery for about a year and a half now and, giving pretty contextual, hopefully very contextual analysis of what's happening in tech. And what the newsletter just does that every day, 3 items, not as long as the articles on Stratechery, but much more like direct and to the point. This is what's happening. This is why I think it's happening.
Yeah.
Things to think about. So,
yeah, it's definitely the thing that can be the most value add. There's so many voices with the tech news, the tech story, but there's so few, I think, voices talking about what it means. And I think Dan and Ben are both really adept. That's why we have you on Twit, because that's what Twit's all about, too, is trying to understand what's going on. The biggest story, of course, Satya Nadella dropped the other shoe and is firing 14% of Microsoft's employees, the largest layoff in the history of Microsoft. They announced this, of course, on Thursday, but Nadella had kind of telegraphed that it was coming in a couple of cryptic emails in which he implied that we are realigning the company. Most of these employees, something like 12,500, were Nokia employees. So I think while it is a huge layoff, it does seem to me that of these 18,000 jobs, the vast majority really are redundant people that were acquired when they merged with Nokia. Ben, is this a sign that Microsoft's in trouble, or is Microsoft doing the right thing?
Well, I mean, it's funny because I've actually been on vacation for the last week, and which is unfortunate that these came down at the time, because if there's, you know,
this is your natural beat, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, one thing I've written about probably more than anything else is Microsoft specifically, the challenges they're facing, how I think they need to kind of align themselves going forward. And actually, I thought the first memo in particular was very encouraging.
He got you too.
I'm happy to go to the mat on this. I think a lot of the criticism focusing on like word length and all this sort of stuff.
3,000 words.
But when you're dealing with a company of 130,000 people, I mean, it's easy enough to sit on the side and say it ought to be like this, without appreciating like this is how it works in a very large corporation with tons of people who are going to be hanging on every word, and you don't worry about keeping the company moving. So there's just a lot that goes into these emails. I agree, in a vacuum, it would be great if they could be, short, succinct, and punchy with, comedic twist towards the end. But that's not the way these communications work. And actually, for communications, for Microsoft communication in particular, I thought it was pretty clear. Like, it was we're going from a company that just a year ago had their CEO saying everything is about Windows, Windows matters, Windows, 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 to a very long email that said the word Windows, at least in the context of the PC operating system, one time. It said the word Nokia one time.
Yeah.
And people focusing on that, oh, there's no change, like, in my opinion, could not be more wrong with that in specifically. Like, it was a complete refocusing of the company. And I wrote, it was very clear that there were further shoes to come down. And obviously one of them came down this week.
That's what Jean-Louis Gasset said. This is the typical email from a CEO. I know. I used to be president at Apple, where you don't want to be too specific, but you want to kind of be able to point to the email and say, "See, I warned you we were going to be laying people off. I told you."
The layoffs were. I thought they were quite clear in the email.
When it was obvious they were going to have to
organizing.
When they acquired Nokia, it was obvious that Nokia has 25,000 employees. There was a lot of overlap.
Yeah, and that's probably the most disappointing thing, actually, honestly, is the fact that post-Nokia, they're still larger than they were pre-Nokia. And I've actually been writing and suggesting that they're going to need more layoffs. I've been writing they're going to need layoffs before the Nokia thing even happened, which I do still think is the case. If you talk about being a productivity company where you're not one of the major platforms, you don't need 105,000 people. And so it would have been better, in my opinion, to have cut deeper and to try to have done it just one time, because I'm not sure that this is going to be enough.
It's pretty clear the stock market stock market always likes cutting jobs, because that means lower costs, theoretically higher profits. But the stock market reacted pretty well. Microsoft stock took a fairly big jump.
Microsoft's stock has been sailing. I mean, they are up, like, they were stuck between 25 and 30 for like a decade.
Yeah.
And they've been in the 40s for quite a while. And again, I don't think that's I think that's because for anyone that's being serious about it, like, there's been very clear shifts. Like, you don't turn an oil. I wanted to write something, so I was trying to look for the right analogy. I was trying to find, like, how long does it take to, like, turn a super tanker? And it takes something like 8 hours. Like, once you, like, start the turning process, like, it doesn't happen right away. And this is the thing with Microsoft, is if ever there were a super tanker in tech, it's them, for better or worse. And to me, that first memo was saying, okay, turn starboard. And the actual process of turning it starboard to then express disappointment that it hasn't yet turned around is to me to be kind of, there's a word for it. I can't remember what it is, but it's not a nice one.
You remember it. You don't want to say it. Dan, sometimes I feel like we're only talking about Microsoft because historically they've been important, but is Microsoft still relevant in a world where everybody's using smartphones and tablets and the cloud?
Well, yeah, of course it's still important. And everyone's using those things, but few hundred million people are also using PCs and Windows. So they're clearly important. Their document formats are still largely standard. They're doing a lot of stuff that is going to be with us for a long time to come. And I agree on that memo. It was certainly wordy and it was certainly all over the place, but you had to read it, I think, in the context of like a State of the Union address, where every department in the government is fighting to get some language in, where it's almost always a giant mess, and most presidents go on way too long when they give it. I think it's in that category. And I really agree with Ben that this is a significant shift. I still don't quite understand why they bought Nokia in the first place.
In fact, they're retrenching a little bit because those Nokia X devices, which were Android phones, looks like at least some of them are now going to be Windows phones again.
Sorry just to jump in, but this is the thing that really irks me about this is people saying blame. Like, I don't know Nadella, but to blame him for Microsoft State as a lot of this criticism
does. Oh, no,
he
inherited it. No.
Yeah,
He's doing the best he can to dig out from years of mismanagement, I think.
Well, it wasn't just the years of mismanagement, though. I mean, what Ballmer did on his way out of the company with reorganizing and then buying Nokia, like, compounded to a significant degree all the problems that Microsoft had.
Ballmer left him with Windows 8, a giant Nokia acquisition, and a whole new goal, devices and services.
It's not a goal. It's a tactic, and it's a tactic that makes no sense.
Yeah, has Nadella abandoned devices and services as an idea?
Yes, that was the best thing about the memo, was he actually very explicitly moved on from devices and services. He's like, this was nice, but we need to move on, and this is what we're going to do instead. And so
I'd have liked to have been at that board meeting. Steve Ballmer's still on the board. Bill Gates is on the board. I'd like to be on the fly on the wall. Satya says, hey, by the way, we're going to change that. You know that devices and services thing? We're not going to do that.
Yeah, no, I have it right here, actually. I'm going to quote from the memo. It says, more recently, we have described ourselves as a, quote, devices and services company. While the devices and services description was helpful in starting our transformation, we now need to hone in on our unique strategy. Like, that is corporate speak for, good Lord, the previous guys messed up. And all this stuff now is about unpacking Steve Ballmer's, like, last 6 months. Like,
yeah.
At the time I wrote it, lots of people wrote it. It still boggles my mind that he could have done all that on the way out the door.
Patterson in our chat room, Dan, says all CEOs have to remodel the kitchen. Is this kitchen remodeling or is this something going a little deeper?
Oh, it's way deeper. And it's pretty clear that, by the way, when the board hired this guy for the CEO job, they knew what was coming. Put it this way, Microsoft is not an incompetent company. Their board is a bunch of smart people. Plainly, he said, here's what I'm going to do if you make me CEO. And they said, fine. I'm certainly willing to believe that Steve Ballmer was not thrilled with that. But, you know, he's one guy on the board at this point and owns a lot of stock. But that's not enough. I think this is an important shift. I don't know where it's going to go. But Microsoft certainly was sort of, you know, running along in place. But keep in mind that when they run in place, they're still printing money. Yes, at a pretty spectacular rate.
But you have to plan for the future. You know that that's not going to continue forever.
Right.
Or you're going to, you know, IBM's still around. Whether they're as relevant, I don't know. But at some point you have to make a Now, well, the good news is, it strikes me, and I think the reason that Nadella got the job, because he was running the enterprise side and the Azure side, the cloud side. Mm-hmm. The good news is the future strikes me. The future really is a cloudy future. A cloud-based future, and that Microsoft is well-positioned with Azure to do that.
The other thing, too, is Nadella opposed the Nokia acquisition.
Did he?
So, I mean, he is absolutely 100% cleaning up a mess that he did not create. And actually, it's that acquisition that, yes, they are smart people on the board, but I do think... I'm going to be looking for changes there over the next year to see, you know, just how much change the company is really willing to think about and go forward with.
Yeah. The devices thought, I mean, I've never been believing that the devices were their future in particular, but I have to say, when they really put their minds to making some good hardware, they do a hell of a job. And, you know, the Xbox is terrific.
Surface, Xbox 360, Surface not so terrific, but Xbox One is good. I mean, they've stumbled a few times.
They have, but they've also gotten some stuff right. They've created a real platform with the Xbox. The Surface, the new one, it looks really nice to me. I'm not saying this is, you know, there's an element of, well, let's be Apple in some of the newer stuff, but that's obviously not going to happen. And I think they had to cut on that one quickly on the phones, because they're just not going anywhere with those.
The other thing
Please,
Ben.
I would say, well, the phones they're cutting, though, they're cutting all the feature phones and all the low-end phones. Like, they're keeping the Lumias. The problem I have with the devices is, you know, the Lumias are very nice, and the Surface especially the most recent version, as you said, is very nice. The problem, though, is the way you sell a device for a premium is because it's differentiated, and you differentiate it most effectively with your own services and your own software on top of it. The problem is the motivation to do that is exactly opposite the motivation you need to be a great services company, full stop. A services company needs to work on all devices. He needs to work on iOS devices. He's going to work on Android devices. He needs to work all over the place. And what's encouraging is Microsoft is making great strides there. Office for iPad is obviously the most visible part of this. But it's problematic for the company to have these two diametrically opposed incentives going on. And especially given its history of being a platform company, of being the Windows company, It actually strikes me, and I think I'm going to write about this for tomorrow, so you're getting a preview. Maybe especially with Nokia on board, like, this would be the time finally to think about, would it be better off being two companies?
Didn't Nadella say pretty explicitly, I'm not going to get, despite the fact we're moving away from devices and services, I'm not getting rid of Xbox. I think he implied we're not getting rid of Nokia. We're not going to spin off or stop Surface. He did kind of put the kibosh on the mini Surface and Windows RT.
Yeah, it's hard to say, though, because he put those way down in the memo and barely mentioned them. And if you want to get into the kind of like corporate memo criminology that, you know, as well, a former...
They're not on top. Into, like, they're not drivers, right. But they're not gone.
That's true. But it doesn't suggest a high... You can go either way on this. Reasonable people can completely disagree. Yeah. I suspect Nadella personally is not a fan of the strategy. I think he's very attuned to the incentive argument that I just laid out, especially with his background. But it's one of those things, like, that's a pretty, you know, he's done a lot. That's going to take more than 6 months.
You know what might be most important to do is to change a toxic corporate culture. It strikes me, and I'm not an insider, obviously, but when I talk to insiders, they say that one of the issues for years with Microsoft was you had all these divisions that were really fighting against each other, and the Office division was going to make damn sure that there was no Office in the iPad, because that would undermine Office, regardless of whether it was a good strategy. Nadella made sure Office on the iPad came out even before Office had a touch version for Windows. It strikes me that one of the things he needs to do is get rid of this toxic culture. Ranking employees, things like that.
And that was Windows not letting Office be on other platforms.
Right.
Because they wanted that to differentiate.
Want to own it. That's right.
Right. Right. Because that was a reason to buy Windows.
Yes. Right.
Yeah.
It's too bad they didn't break up the company about 15 years ago. Then
that's what Dvorak always called for. He said there should be three Microsofts. You'd triple the value, because each company has value, but they have disparate goals, and there's no sense in having it all be one. I suppose Nadella could still do this, although it seems like has passed.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. It's funny, because I'm sympathetic to both arguments on that. You know, back when the Justice Department thing was, you know, they're having their legal troubles. Even then, though, like, it was still a very cohesive, like, positive feedback cycle for the company. Windows supporting Office, supporting Server, supporting Office. Today, though, I mean, like, what is Windows really doing for Microsoft's cloud services?
It feels like Windows is legacy. And Nadella recognizes this, that he's saying, we're going to be cross-platform.
The problem, though, is, like, you can say that, the CEO can say that, and this gets into the whole the memo stuff and changing culture stuff, but to actually have that trickle down through the bureaucracy and to actually have
that's my question.
Act differently.
Is he prepared to reinvent this toxic corporate culture that has held Microsoft back?
Well, you know the saying that's pretty true, which is that culture eats strategy for breakfast. So we'll see.
No, totally. And the thing about a toxic corporate culture is it's not usually toxic per se. It's more like rancid. Like, it's like food that was very good.
I think that's much more apt. Yeah. Well. Microsoft's not toxic. It's not rancid.
Because
it's gone bad.
Well, it's gone bad.
Yeah.
It's not appropriate for the current environment. And and to me, that's the worry is the everything has to support Windows. Everything has to support our platform and support phone. That's the Microsoft. That's worked for them for 25 years, and now that's exactly what they need to not do. And I'm not sure that that can be done by fiat.
Well, talking about toxic corporate culture, we're going to talk about toxic customer service. The customer service call heard round the world coming up in just a moment. We got a call from Ryan Block's mother apparently yesterday saying, Ryan does not want to be known for this. Sorry, Ryan. Too late. Just as Kevin Rose is known as a raccoon thrower, Ryan Block now is known as he who slays Comcast customer service. We'll talk about that in just a minute. Ben
you got
Thompson.
To put a link to the raccoon throwing video. I forgot about that.
We got Kevin on the next day. We tried
Leo,
to get.
Are you really sure you want to go to a commercial? What makes you believe that you need to go to a commercial right now? Why do you do that? I mean, give us a reason.
I want to go to a commercial. Please, I beg you.
No, we need a better reason than that. Come on.
You're interrupting the number one technology nutcast online. I mean, why would you want to interrupt this?
Okay, good.
No, we can't allow it. I'm sorry. You have to give us a better explanation.
I'm still suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome from listening to that call, and you do this now? Dan Gilmer is also here, great journalist and writer at The Guardian, but now professor. Some lucky students at Arizona State who are getting him in the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism. But first, a word from our friends, because I'm going to go to a commercial. I don't care what you say. From Citrix, who do GoToMeeting. Citrix GoToMeeting is the way. If you've got a team that's spread out, who doesn't now? We have people all over the world who work for us. If you've got clients, people you're pitching spread out, of course, because you're a global entity, there's really no way to meet with these people in person. You still got to meet. You still got to pitch. You still got to present. You need Citrix GoToMeeting, the number one way to do this. You share the same screen, so you're all on the same page, literally. You turn on that HD video conferencing. You're literally seeing each other face-to-face. It's better than meeting in person. It's a lot better than a teleconference. Whenever we're going to do a voice conference, we start a GoToMeeting because that way you have all of those features available. You can even present from an iPad. Or, you know, I mean, you're mobile, too. So you can be mobile. You can be joining a meeting. You can be presenting. Start your 30-day free trial of Citrix GoToMeeting by visiting GoToMeeting.com. Take a look at the features. I mean, we're talking very nice HD video. You can have those faces at the top of the screen and the side of the screen. You can see the screen that the presenter is showing, the PowerPoint presentation, the spreadsheet, the document you're collaborating on. It really is the best way to meet from the convenience, not only of your computer, but also your mobile device, your smartphone, and your tablet. And the best part is you pay one low, flat monthly rate. You meet as many times as you want, as long as you want, with anyone from anywhere in a single virtual space. I know teams that keep GoToMeeting running all day. Share screens, present in real time, turn on those webcams. You're going to love it. GoToMeeting, if you are in a distributed environment, a distributed workforce, if you've got clients and colleagues elsewhere, you got to try this. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click the Try It Free button, and all we ask, use the promo code TWIT for 30 days free. TWIT, right there.
Right there in the offer code.
GoToMeeting. You know, one of the things, and we've played this, you know, it all started, I think it was Monday or Tuesday, I saw Veronica Belmont post on Google+. She said, I was on the, we're moving, and we wanted to replace Comcast with Astound, which they're lucky. They live in San Francisco. There are other choices in most of the country. About 80% really only has choice between their cable company and their phone company. So we called Comcast and tried to cancel. Veronica's on the phone with him for 10 minutes. Ryan, her husband's listening. Of course, Ryan, we all know both of them have been on the show many times. And Ryan's listening and hears Veronica become increasingly frustrated. Fortunately, he starts a recorder and the whole world heard the customer service call from hell. I'm not going to repeat it because you probably all heard it by now.
If you have to fill out your form, that's fine. Please proceed to the next question.
That's Ryan.
And we'll attempt to answer that if possible.
Who maintains his cool?
We are the number one provider of internet and TV service in the entire country.
Number one.
Why is it that you're not wanting to have the number one rated internet service, number one rated TV service available?
You just want to punch the guy now. That's only minute 12. It goes on and on and on. Ryan says in his post on the SoundCloud post of the audio that he'd already given the guy the reasons. It wasn't that he was withholding anything. The guy didn't want to hear the reasons. And what we've learned since, and I've received, Jeff Jarvis received, others have received messages, emails, posts from former Comcast representatives, current Comcast customer service folks, third-party Comcast customer reps, and all of them pretty much agree that the issue is the corporate culture, that Comcast, in effect, pays these guys a certain amount, and every time somebody cancels on their watch, they lose money. And at some point, they can get down to minimum wage if enough people cancel on their watch. In fact, you'll hear the rep very early on say, can't you just go to the Comcast store and cancel there? That's not because he's trying to keep Ryan from canceling. He's trying to keep Ryan from canceling on this phone call. But this is another issue that I didn't know about. This was from a paste bin post that went to Jeff Jarvis. The big issue Comcast, this is a guy who's a Comcast rep, the big issue Comcast reps face, the systems we use are broken. As Comcast has essentially bought its way to the top, the computer programs haven't been upgraded. You know what? I always thought this, because you hear, you're on the line with it, and there's long pauses. He says, frequently I have to restart my computer with a customer on the phone, but I'm not allowed to tell them that. Comcast doesn't want the customer to know that their systems aren't perfect. Time is money. If Comcast can push the blame onto the customer as fast as possible, that's the best result. He says the whole system, this is a toxic culture. Comcast apologized to Ryan, said, we're going to look into this. It's never going to happen again. Ryan Block, very, I think, rightly so, said on Twitter, I don't want you to fire the guy. I want you to reinvent yourself so that you're not a company that promotes this kind of behavior. Who hasn't had this happen to them? In fact, Ryan works at AOL, who was notorious for this kind of customer retention. Have any of you, either of you, had calls, customer service calls like this?
Oh God, who hasn't?
Who hasn't?
It's getting a new customer is a lot harder than keeping an old one, or it should be. And these guys, it's quite clear, their incentive, financially and otherwise, is to not let anyone go if at all possible. Speaking of San Francisco, we were getting the San Francisco Chronicle Sunday edition, and finally decided after they killed a section we particularly liked reading that there wasn't enough to get it anymore. And I spent 15 minutes trying to be polite to a guy who kept lowering the amount that I'd have to pay if we would just keep it. When you make a decision, you've made the decision. It's really odd. And companies need to know how to take no for an answer, to just move on. They'd probably be better off not having people annoyed at them all the time.
And I think you can. I think there's ample evidence now that treating the customer better is in the long run better business. Look at Amazon. Here's a company that's customer first. You call to send something back. They happily exchange it. Zappos, yeah, another example, now an Amazon company. I think the evidence is strongly in favor of having a better customer relationship and not worrying so much about customer attention. You agree, Ben?
Well, I love that we're discussing this story right after Microsoft, actually, for two reasons. One is it really emphasizes or really shows off how powerful incentives are, right? Like, I don't, I'm happy to give this customer service representative the benefit of the doubt and that he's a nice guy. He's a great guy, and he goes out with his friends, and he doesn't, like, insist that he buy them a beer, like, for 30 minutes.
Why won't you buy me a beer? I'm the number one friend you'll ever know. You're not going to get a better friend. You should buy me a beer.
The whole point is that this isn't natural human behavior, but he is being heavily incentivized to act in a certain way, and that is not his responsibility. That's Comcast's responsibility. And incentives are incredibly powerful things that act mostly on kind of a subconscious level. And that's why, I worry for Microsoft if they have misaligned incentives. It's not because there are bad people there that are dumb. It's because people respond to incentives whether they realize they're doing it or not. And this is just an extreme example of that. Point two is, I mean, if I think the Comcast service sucks, what am I going to do? This is where
that's why this exists. It's a monopoly.
Exactly.
Well, you know, there's a cynic might look at this particular situation and say, Comcast, in the throes of trying to basically gobble up what's left of the broadband industry, apart from them, you know, one might think, if one was really cynical, that this is all a setup so that they can say to the world, see, we have competition. People want to leave us. I'm not.
Ryan Block has a choice.
And, you know, that's unlikely, but it is odd that they're so panicked about one guy leaving.
We invited Ryan to come on the show and talk about this. He is declining to do all media interviews because he wants it all to go away. But you know what, Ryan, you did everybody a service. And this was the shot heard around the world. David Letterman played it. The networks played it. It was on the news everywhere. It got a lot of play because it resonated, I think, with everybody listening to it. We've all been on that call. And I have to think this is going to have some serious impact on Comcast, perhaps even on the Comcast-Time Warner merger. This is a company that, you know, maybe they're not alone. Maybe a lot of companies act like this, but it's pretty clearly a company that is mistreating its employees and its customers. And really, should they be allowed to grow any bigger?
Well, see, I presume it's
5 million views, 5 million listens on SoundCloud. Wow.
I don't think it will have an impact, though, because, I mean, like I said, like, what are you going to do? I'm already disgusted with Comcast. Like, how much more disgusted can I be? And I'm still going to be a subscriber because I value high-speed internet more than I value, like, my integrity and the companies
it's true.
That I give my money to.
It's honest. Stockholm syndrome. We are held hostage. I'm a Comcast internet customer. You know what? I have a tale very similar. On Friday, I was late for dinner because I was on the line with Comcast. And I actually pay Comcast twice for internet. I upgraded to Comcast Business, but I cannot for the life of me get them to turn off the consumer internet. I'm afraid that if I do that, they'll turn off everything. And I can't afford to be without internet. They have me.
You know, at home, we have two services. We use Comcast as well as Sonic.net for
Sonic's
DSL.
Sonic's awesome. There's an example of a beautifully run company.
If we had actual competition for very high-speed broadband, and by the way, Comcast's fastest service is not really all that high-speed compared to what people in other countries are getting.
But compared to what we're getting in this country, it is.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's still, you know, laughable when you think about what's possible. So that's the real issue here. We don't have serious competition for actual broadband. And the way Congress is going, it doesn't look like we ever will. And that's going to be tragic for the future of this country in innovation and communications.
You know,
we're having...
Go ahead, Ben.
Oh, no, I was just going to anecdotally, I mean, we've been having a few connection issues with me here. I'm actually in the United States this time. Last time I was in Taiwan.
Yeah, welcome home, by the way. Yeah.
Yeah, just for the summer. But no, it's every time I come back to the States, it's jarring. Like,
it's better in Taiwan?
Infinitely better. I mean, I have like 100 down and 40 up, and I pay like $30 a month.
Is it government run or is it a private industry?
Well, so they have it's very, the whole net neutrality thing and the competition thing is very complicated in the U.S. But in Taiwan, it is like it is in Europe and lots of other countries. There's a separation between owning the wires and providing the service. So there's lots of ISPs that offer service over the same wires. The other thing too, because it's much more densely populated, is that DSL is actually more of a viable solution. Because if you're within like a mile or 2 miles of a switch, then it can be very high speed. But there's more competition on the cable wire, and there's more types of connections, both of which make a huge difference.
And who owns the wire? Does the government own the wire?
That's a good question.
I bet it does.
I think it's the national. I'm not sure. I shouldn't say anything because I'll probably be wrong.
So this is one thing that. I'm really torn on the net neutrality issue, and this comes down to that. A lot of people, including Alexis Ohanian and many people at EFF and others, think that the solution is for the FCC to declare telecommunications broadband providers covered by Title II of the Telecommunications Act, that they are common carriers or utilities, hence should be regulated by the FCC. On the other hand, I've heard from a lot of people that's the last thing you want. And of course, and even at the EFF, I know I've talked to John Perry Barlow, says there's dissent among the board at the EFF because while, yes, we want a free and open internet, many of us feel the worst possible thing you could do is have the government start to intervene on how the internet is run. Title II could be, in fact, the worst thing that could happen to the internet, and it's hard for us to know ahead of time. I think something, though, that everyone agrees on is that the real key to this is having true competition. And one way to do it is to have the government own the infrastructure and then open up the internet providing on top of it to a total competition. I mean, one of the reason we have monopolies or a duopoly is because it's so expensive to put the cable in the ground that the FCC said to the cable companies, you can have a regional monopoly to, you know, pay for the cost of trenching. Maybe the time is to give that up. I don't know. But I do feel like competition is a solution. Is that even viable in the United States? We've got such a mess going on right now. It just seems like it's better than Title II, which has huge inherent risks.
I'm very mixed as well for many of those reasons. I mean, there's lots of stuff going on here. I mean, first off, the government did give, and remember they started with community access television, which was basically a shared antenna, which
CATV, is
how most cable got started.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And in this case, like because government didn't want to pay for all the installation, they made a deal. And so the people, yes, government provided lots of value, particularly in eminent domain and things like that. But the actual cost of putting that cable in the ground was borne by shareholders.
By the way, I noticed that as soon as we start talking about this stuff, the internet goes to hell. We've lost both Dan and Ben. You know who our provider is here in the Brick House Studios? Comcast. I think they pulled the switch.
I know. They're mad at what I was saying. I'm back now. Can you hear me?
I don't think it's you guys because it's happening here. The worst company in the world. I'll say it again. I hear you, Ben. Tell you what, we're going to take a break. We'll continue this conversation. Good. While we attempt to get our internet back in order.
It's a good thing. Net neutrality is a very deep rabbit hole. We may never come out.
Yeah. We've talked, I mean, almost every show for the last 6 months, it's ended up descending into this net neutrality discussion. I'm just coming to the opinion that competition is a solution. Whatever we can do to foster competition, that's going to be better than having heavy-handed government regulation of the internet because all of a sudden, I don't want to have to adhere to FCC rules at TWIT. And I think that would be the worst possible thing to happen.
Yeah, I think it's a little overdone, but what you're right on is it's another incentive issue. Like, we need to have the right incentives in place. And the incentive is also to keep building infrastructure. I mean, Mark Andreessen had one of the best statements in this whole thing, which is that the problem with comparing the internet to the sewage system is we don't, you know, crap 10 times more in every 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, Comcast there is some legitimate concern from the internet service providers that we're using a lot more bandwidth all the time. There's a back and forth over Netflix right now. Verizon released a very deceptive diagram that clearly shows, using colors, that the problem is all Netflix's. Because it's Netflix is red. Everything else is green, but Netflix is red. I think a lot of people looked at that diagram and said, oh, yeah, it's obvious. Level 3 kind of chimed in and said, yeah, that's a little bit misleading. The real issue is not how much bandwidth's inside of Netflix network, how much bandwidth's inside of our network, how much bandwidth's inside of Comcast. In all three cases, there's plenty. It's the interconnects. And what Level 3, who is one of Comcast's backbone providers, has said again and again, we are willing even to give money to Comcast to upgrade their interconnect. Their interconnect is not fast enough. We're providing them with huge amount of bandwidth, a giant pipe. They got a little bitty pipe, and they consistently refuse. Verizon, Comcast, the five big ISPs in the U.S. refuse to upgrade that pipe. We'll even pay for it, and they won't do it. And the reason is they want to put the screws to Netflix and say, oh, you see, it's all Netflix fault, but it's really that little bitty pipe that Comcast and, in this case, Verizon has it attached. Anyway, it's a mess. It's one of those subjects that you have to have expertise in technology, in politics. You have to have inside information on how the backbone's working. Yeah. No one really, certainly no senator, no Congress member could possibly fathom this, no member of the court system, and no technology journalist. It's something so hideously complex.
But it's not, though, actually, Leo. It's
good. It's, cut through this.
It's a lot of the technology in the back is complex, but you had it right the first time. You separate the provision of the access, which is a service, from the content inside the service. That's not easy to do at this point because we've let these people create these mega companies that combine it, and we've given them permission to make decisions about what bits get delivered. But that doesn't have to be. They can make plenty of money by being the providers of the pipe and selling access to people who then provide it in turn to the rest of us. It's really, Title II is a problematic thing to do, but it could be done with a very light touch that would just encourage competition. I think we're sometimes trying to think about the horribles that might happen when we can see right in our face things that are going on and that are going to get much worse in the very near future if we don't do something fairly quickly.
I agree.
Very well put.
Yeah. Bob Frankston, one of the creators of VisiCalc, right, is a big promoter of community internet. He says local communities should use eminent domain. This is controversial. To use eminent domain to take over these infrastructures that the cable company, the phone companies have put in. Say, look, thank you very much. Nice job. You've amortized your investment. Glad about that. Now we're going to take it over, and we will lease them back to providers, as many providers as we possibly can, to provide competition. That this is public infrastructure. This is the gas, the sewer, the water, and we'll run it, and we'll let many companies float over it. And for sure, if you do that, there'll be one company that says, "And we're not going in any way restrict what you do. We're not going to packet sniff. That's all you need is competition. One company. SonicNet's a good example of a company. Dane Jasper, they're the CEO, an independent internet service provider who has for a long time said, look, we're not metering. We're not shaping. We're not doing anything. You get all the bits you want.
And the cost of providing the bits is dropping like a stone. So the arguments from the telecoms that, oh, my God, all this stuff that's being used, well, their cost of providing it is dropping, and their ability to get more and more things in the same lines is expanding at a pretty rapid rate too. I hope we get this right, but I
despair.
Pretty much afraid.
I completely despair.
We're getting into the lobbying and money in government and all that sort of stuff.
It's just crazy. Yeah, none of this is ever going to happen. We get the internet we deserve.
You are going into the next ad spot on a very depressing tone. I'm not sure.
Okay, let me lift you up. Upbeat. Surely there's a tap dancing kid who can do great yo-yo tricks that we can just show that video for a few seconds and everybody forget their troubles. Chad, you must have something like that.
Yeah, that'll work.
Let me quickly look into my bag of tricks.
No, we need Kevin Rose throwing the raccoon. That will work perfectly.
Kevin Rose throwing a raccoon. Anything like that we could
Well, you could play that call again.
We need. No, that's depressing too. We need really to have a little bumper, something that we could drop in. That's what YouTube's for, isn't it? YouTube is to distract us from the grim reality of our lives. I believe that's in their charter.
Until Comcast throttles.
Until Comcast throttles.
Here you go. I have the next best thing.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we pause for this word from
a child with spoon on his eyes.
Thank you very much, child.
Hey, I'm sorry I didn't see you there. I was too busy blocking out the haters.
Thank you, YouTube. Our show today brought to you by...
That was awful.
Doesn't matter. It cheered you up. If you are managing a giant project, a giant software project, and you are daunted by the challenges posed, surely you have heard of Atlassian and their great product, Jira. If you haven't, try it right now. Jira is one of the world's most powerful, customizable issue and project management systems. We were talking about how important the software systems are in a company like Comcast, where the systems don't work. That means the reps can't do their job. That means customer service suffers. Having great systems can transform what you're doing. And Jira is an example of that. It will capture and organize your workflow. You can prioritize what you're doing, take action on what's important, stay up to date with the activity going on around you. You can capture, organize, prioritize all the issues, all the tasks, the features, the bugs in your giant project. Give your team a very easy-to-use interface, lets them collaborate in real time. Actually, you play the video on the Atlassian Jira site, because it really is, if you're in this situation, you know you need this. You can integrate all the documents from all the different places, your backlogs, your issues, your code repository. It works with Git, of course. In fact, that allows teams to follow the code all the way from development to delivery.
You know, it's funny. I didn't realize this, but I've actually been using Jira for years.
What?
Here, let me see if I can find it. I've been using it because Minecraft.
You're not a programmer.
No, but Minecraft's bug tracker has been a Jira product. They're using that, and it's just wonderful because I have intimate knowledge of everything because I've issued a few bugs.
Isn't that awesome?
Yeah, and they do these amazing things with it.
See,
like
there's
people,
the activity stream on the right.
There's the activity stream on the right. On. You can see this is kind of amazing. These are the bugs that are created versus the bugs resolved.
Isn't that good? That's looking good.
And then it shows off the known issues.
Is this something Mojang uses? Or?
Yeah, this is something Mojang uses, the creators of Minecraft. There's lots of really nice features, like you can merge if one topic is posted and then it's posted a second time by another user, didn't realize it was already posted. You can merge topics. You can easily add screenshots and crash reports, and there's comment history, and you can close and open tickets. It's just amazing.
I had no idea. Is that funny that you've been using it?
I've been using it for years, and I had no idea that this was. And it was. And I kept thinking, like, gosh, this is such a good system. Whoever built this system is so good. And it was Jira this whole time, Atlassian.
And what's nice is I'm sure Mojang has added to it. They have REST APIs that make it very easy to add some specifics to your situation. It's flexible, simple, easy enough for a 5-person startup, but reliable enough for 100,000 people. That's why NASA uses it. 70% of the Fortune 100 use it. 25,000 companies, apparently including Mojang. If you haven't tried Jira, you can now go to Atlassian, Atlassian.com/twit for more information. Monthly plans, very affordable, as little as $10 a month for up to 10 users. But we've got it free for 30 days. I think you'll be pleased. Systems make such a difference in large projects. If it's just you, you don't need it. But if you've got a team, Atlassian.com/twit, try it for free, 30 days. And we thank them for their support of This Week in Tech. They obviously feel that many big thinkers are watching this show. That's good news. Okay, we're not going to talk about net neutrality. It's screwed. We're screwed. It's over. No, I don't know what's going to happen. We'll find out. You mentioned that you expected, I think it was Dan mentioned, that you expected to see the Microsoft board change to a little bit to reflect Satya Nadella's goals for the company. Google's doing a little bit of that. I see that Alan Mulally, who just left as CEO of Ford, one of the most respected CEOs in the U.S., truly a genius who not only, I think, turned Ford around, made sure it was protected. They never took government loans when all the other big threes did. They don't have the problems that GM's going through right now. Mullally retired as a CEO. He was briefly considered, or at least mentioned as considered, to be CEO of Microsoft. I don't think that was ever in the cards. He really wanted, I think, to have some time and wanted to be with his family. But he has taken a job as a Google director. He's going to be on the board of Google. In fact, I was looking at the Google board of directors, and there's an example of a company that has created a board of directors that very much signify the direction the company's interested in. Of course, Larry and Sergey, the founders, are on it, as is Eric Schmidt. He's the chairman. John Doerr, investor, and I think probably as part of the investment, they got the seat. Diane Greene, who founded VMware. So there's your cloud and your software folks. John Hennessy, who's president of Stanford. There's actually two academics on the board. The president of Princeton as well is on the board. And then Paul Otellini, formerly CEO of Intel, is on the board. This is all Google. Ann Mather is on the board. She worked at Shutterfly. She worked at Netflix. You've got a board that really reflects kind of all there's, and Mullally going on the board is, of course, automotive, all of the interests that Google has. Former Amazon guy, Ram Shriram. I am right now, Microsoft's board is really kind of a hodgepodge. You've got Ken Thompson's very active, former IBM guy, and you've got Bill Gates, you've got Steve Ballmer, you've got Satya Nadella, and the rest almost seem like just kind of placeholders. I can imagine a reinvigorated Microsoft board that would not only help the stock market understand what Microsoft's up to, but help Satya Nadella forge his vision. I don't know where I'm going with that.
It's not the most attractive job in the world, though.
Maybe. You know what? You get a lot of money, don't you?
It's good money. I mean, most people who are considered for these positions don't need the money.
It's prestigious.
That is the case.
Hey, I'll volunteer. I could help.
Well, the interesting piece on the Microsoft board is they have the Value Act.
Yes, the activist investors got a seat.
Right. So that'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But I mean, I think the Bill Gates question, I think, is still out there. I mean, obviously, he was going to be more involved under Nadella. I haven't heard.
I don't see
much
any evidence that Bill is advising Satya Nadella at all.
Well, I mean,
where's Bill's hand in any of this?
I've heard he has been on campus more frequently than I mean, especially I did hear that more a few months ago. I don't know if that's continued to be the case or not, but in general, Microsoft's board will probably always be weak as long as he is on it.
Sure. Because if Bill stands up and says, no, we're going to do this, people are going to listen.
Yeah. The thing to do with Google is their board is way weaker because they can't actually do anything because the way Google's shares corporate governance is set up, Sergey and Larry Page and Eric Schmidt have complete control.
Oh, really?
So the board is really just they're there, but they can't actually do anything. Which Facebook is the same way, which is. It's interesting for lots of reasons. A lot of people on Wall Street and in finance are very concerned about it. But there's obviously pluses and minuses.
Yeah, I would think, I mean, if at least you use the board, even if they have no literal power in an advisory capability, you've got very smart people on
the board. No, absolutely.
I
think your analysis of the Google board is spot on. I think that's exactly what they're doing.
Leaning man. I mean, these are good people, and they could be very helpful in guiding you. Even if you, Larry Page, are making all the decisions,
and that's also a much more attractive job. You're on a company that's going in the right direction,
right?
So there's not much pressure,
right? Apple has teamed up with IBM. I gotta find the picture of Steve Jobs flipping off the IBM sign back in the early days. Here's the image. He very famously, when he was, they were just starting out. They were young. They were full of vim and vigor. He went to the IBM building, I think in New York, and very famously flipped it off. In fact, for many years, IBM was the hated evil empire. They in the 1984 commercial, it was pretty obvious who the woman holding the hammer was throwing it at. It was IBM. Well, things have changed a little bit in the modern era. IBM and Apple are teaming up for a huge enterprise push. Ben, I figured you'd understand. Is this a big deal or is this just PR material?
No, this is a huge deal, and it's a really brilliant deal. It really came out of left field, I think, as far... I mean, I haven't heard anyone talking about this previously. The reason it's a big deal is, I mean, Apple is kind of succeeding in the enterprise in a way they never have, almost by accident right now. They have done work on the product side for iOS to make it work well in the enterprise, especially in iOS 8 has quite a bit. For the first time, iOS 8 actually had the WWC keynote had a section devoted to the enterprise. Previously, they have a slide.
Yeah.
But now they spent a little bit of time talking about it. So, obviously, it's a very big market. I mean, BlackBerry has traditionally dominated it, but iOS is kind of like becoming the default device there. So that from that perspective, they're well-shaped from a product perspective, but what Microsoft knows and is good at, and what lots of enterprise companies knows and are good at, and why it's hard to build an enterprise company, is that enterprise is the product is one very small piece of the whole puzzle. It's the support. It's the especially support. It's the working with IT. It's developing needs. It's developing all the applications that are specific to the enterprise. It's working with their systems, with their backend systems, with their cloud, whatever it might be. And all that is messy and it's dirty. And you go in, you listen to the customer, and you tell them what they want to hear, and you respond to their needs. And it's very, very counter to Apple's philosophy and way of developing products. And this is why Apple has always kind of disdained the enterprise, not because there's not money there, there's a ton of money there, but because it would poison the sort of culture that they have around building the best possible products.
But what, and in some ways, it was also the enterprise disdained Apple, right?
Well, absolutely. I mean, and for good reason. I mean, there was mutual hatred on both sides, and both well deserved, to be perfectly frank. And now what Apple's basically getting is IBM is going to do all that. They don't need to develop that. They don't need to develop all that messiness and worrying about it. And I would imagine from IBM's perspective, actually, IBM is probably getting a very good deal out of this. Like, I would imagine Apple's going to – they'll get the device money, which is all they ever kind of really want in the end anyway. And they might get a little bit extra for support. But IBM – you know, in an enterprise deal, the product is only a small part of the total cost. Like the whole service on top of that is where most of the money is made. And so I would imagine for both companies, it's a massive win-win. Apple can sell much more effectively, way more devices, and IBM has a marquee product to kind of base their enterprise strategy around. It's a brilliant deal. It's very hard to see any sort of downside to it, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not the first time IBM and Apple have worked together, though. They go back to the PowerPC, the Intelligent project,
right?
Things like that. But Apple was a lot smaller in the period, in those periods. So
that's a good point. I mean, Pink, the IBM. Right. By the way, which never emerged.
No, yeah. It was classic vaporware. There was a joke in the 90s when people were talking seriously about Apple and IBM, and at one point there was a rumor that IBM was going to buy Apple, and
I remember that.
So there was a riddle that came out of that, which was, what do you get when you combine Apple and IBM? And the answer was IBM.
Boy, that would change totally. Today, wouldn't it?
It sure would.
The difference is both PowerPC and Intelligent were products, and they were working jointly on a product. In this case, the lines of division are very, very clear. Apple provides the product and IBM provides the service. And because IBM doesn't really build products anymore, and so to me that gives the partnership a much greater chance of success. I mean, going back to incentives, like the incentives are very well aligned for this, and that's kind of the key to making any sort of partnership work well.
I'm pretty sure IBM will end up getting some small cut of the hardware price too, but it's probably a pretty smart deal for both companies.
Is it targeted against Microsoft or Google or both?
Yes.
Microsoft has a very compelling mobile enterprise strategy. I mean, right? I mean, if you're in the enterprise, already you love Microsoft, and it seems like, you know, with Windows Phone, there's a pretty nice unified platform there.
You don't actually. This is one of the things that's the most confusing about Windows Phone is the most recent version has kind of added some basics, like some must-haves when it comes to enterprise, but they've been way behind iOS.
Oh, interesting.
When it comes to enterprise support.
I was just assuming that they would pay attention to enterprise. It's such a big part of Microsoft's business.
Well, Windows Mobile was, for sure. But right. Windows Phone, they reset, and it was a very explicit sort of consumer product. And to my mind, that was kind of the nail in the coffin for the whole thing. Had they kind of granted Apple, you know, and Android the consumer space then and said, okay, well, the ship sails 2010. We are going to be the enterprise phone takeover for BlackBerry.
That would have been a smart move.
Yeah, I think they'd be in a much stronger position.
But clearly, iOS has taken over for BlackBerry, not because it's got such a great enterprise story, but just because that's what the users wanted. BYOD. They brought their own device into the enterprise, and it was always an iPhone.
It has the best enterprise support of all the major platforms.
It does.
I mean,
Android has been pretty messy.
Samsung
and others are actually doing some pretty heavy lifting to try and make Android more enterprise.
Samsung has Knox, which is a secure platform. Although at Google I/O, Google announced that they were going to allow you to kind of have the mullet of phones. Your Android phone will have a party in the front, business in the back, or was it the other way around? You'd have your business stuff, and it would be separated from your personal stuff.
Which is easy to do now for all kinds of reasons, including the fact you can pack so much storage into tiny device.
Interesting story coming out of HOPE, the Hackers on Planet Earth conference in New York City this week. A slide deck from Jonathan Zdziarski. I hope I'm saying your name right, Jonathan. Identifying backdoors, attack points, and surveillance mechanisms in iOS. We had talked quite a bit on our security show. Steve Gibson had looked into the white papers Apple had put out about security first on iPhone, particularly on the newest iPhones, and came away quite impressed. I don't know. I forwarded this document to Steve. We'll talk about it on Security Now on Wednesday. But holy cow, if you read these PowerPoints, I guess the big takeaway from this is that Apple has all sorts of services. Well, this is it. Apple's worked hard to make iOS devices secure against typical attackers, but they've put all sorts of stuff in to allow law enforcement access to this data. And in fact, all iOS devices are currently running a packet sniffer that allows these devices with the appropriate software to look at everything that's going on over the network entirely. That in fact, the iPhone is terrifying. There are undocumented services that bypass encryption. If you may assume if you've got an iPhone that when you shut it off and you've got the lock screen on that your data is encrypted. Not in fact the case. If the device hasn't been rebooted, all the data that has been encrypted can be accessed easily with, all of Apple's software gives up its information completely, immediately, easily. It's really kind of a surprising. Now, we haven't heard Apple's response to this, but I most particularly would like to hear about this Lockdown D and this packet sniffer that is apparently running. I mean, PCAP D, Zdziarski asks, why do we need a packet sniffer running on 600 million personal iOS devices?
Because it's there.
It's there.
And they, you know, look, all of mobile is a horror story now when it comes to privacy and security. It's all a horror story.
Well, I guess that's the message, that those of us who thought foolishly, oh, Apple's protecting us, we now know that's not the case. Is that right?
I don't know why anyone trusts any of the major technology companies when it comes to things like this because the laws are basically against us ever finding out. They get served with these national security letters or other
right.
secret government orders they can't tell us about. I think they need to do a better job of fighting for us, but this is going to take a while to fix.
This is what Jonathan says. He says, com.apple.pcapd immediately starts libcap on the device, dumps network traffic and HTTP request and response data traveling into and out of the device. It does not require developer mode. It is active on every iOS device. It can be targeted via Wi-Fi for remote monitoring, so you can use Wi-Fi to get into somebody's phone and then monitor the network with it. There is no visual indicator to the user that the packet sniffer is running, and it's on every single iOS device. Now, again, this is Jonathan's presentation. He is a very credible security researcher. He does offer an example from iOS 7.1.2, the current version of iOS, of a hex dump that he got from a phone. It's pretty terrifying. You tie that with Edward Snowden's conversations, most recently with Daniel Ellsberg at HopeX. Hope was a good conference to go to. I'm sorry I missed it.
I actually was there yesterday. Were you? And Friday. And just got back. It's really fabulous conference. It's think of it as DEF CON for people with social responsibility. It's pretty wonderful.
It was started by Emmanuel Goldstein of 2600, was it not?
I believe so.
Is it still run by them, or
they're still involved? And you know, it's a wonderful gathering.
Did you go to the Snowden event?
I actually missed that, but nobody could. It was so crowded.
It was
nobody could
pretty popular.
Get into the room.
Yeah.
Well, actually, a lot of people got in the room, but most people didn't.
Yeah.
Or a number of people didn't, anyway.
Snowden's been saying some interesting things, I have to say. For instance, he says, if you want privacy, don't use Dropbox. Dropbox is the most anti-privacy of all the services. He points to the fact that Condoleezza Rice, who the former Bush official security advisor, who was, he says, very instrumental in privacy reversals during the Bush administration, is on the board of directors. He recommended an alternative, which we've recommended as well before.
Spider Oak.
Yeah, I've used Spider Oak for some time. Your data is encrypted prior to its transfer up to the servers. Dropbox, as we know, encrypts your data, but everybody at Dropbox has access to it.
So sorry, I missed this paper. I like I said, I've been on vacation. So you've got some reading to do, Ben. I do. Were all these? I'm a little confused by the packet sniffer on a phone thing. Because I mean, isn't the phone's running its own OS? Isn't kind of by definition a packet sniffer? Like is all this about having local access to the phone or
no?
As he points out, you can
get Wi-Fi access to the phone and then sniff it. And law enforcement can turn it on. You know what? I am not an expert in security. You might want to go to Jonathan's website, zdziarski.com. He says he published this in a paper months ago, but it wasn't until he put it in PowerPoint slides at Hope that anybody even talked about it, which doesn't really surprise me. But we're talking about it now, and I think it is worth probably paying some more attention to it.
You know, and the mobile privacy in general is such a joke because of permissions that the applications all demand. And I've just moved my two phones to Cyanogen Mod, which is a third-party Android variant that has a much better privacy built in. But I don't take for granted that even that is going to be sufficient. And this is a problem that I'm not sure the market itself is going to be able to solve because in part of the concentration among a few carriers that are practically married to the government when it comes push to shove. So we're really we have a big, big, difficult problem to solve here.
At least CyanogenMod is open source, so presumably could be audited. What we learned with TrueCrypt is that people can have access to your source code It doesn't mean it's secure. It just means that they have access to your source code. And we're all, those of us who are unable to look at the source code and really, truly vet it, are all kind of just hoping somebody's doing that.
Well, the Windows version actually was still binary, so that that was always one of the issues, was that the Windows version of TrueCrypt, no one really knew what was going on. But even, I mean, they basically said, don't trust any of them, or that's the implication.
Yeah, they've given up.
Well, there's a project that may come together to, if they can find a way to do it, to get the TrueCrypt Linux code and work with that for a new project. But
well, there
are ownership issues.
Of course, the Johns Hopkins researcher who raised money, was it on Indiegogo, to do a TrueCrypt audit, is continuing on with his audit. And I guess he has access to the
Matthew
source.
Green.
Matthew Green, that's right.
I think probably there is, I think, a silver lining here, though, which is law enforcement now, according to the Supreme Court, does need a warrant to access your phone. At least from that perspective, in all likelihood, that's going to, like, this will be a legal protection.
Well, it helps you on the ground. It helps you if you get pulled over in a traffic stop and the cop takes your phone and plugs it into a device and takes a data dump. You can't do that anymore without a warrant. But it doesn't help you against the NSA in the least.
No, that's a whole other thing, yeah.
And then there are these systems that police have working in lots of places around the country to basically scarf up everything and fake out the tower and pretend that they're one of the cell phone towers.
That was one of
the traffic goes. They're making deals with the manufacturers to keep it secret. And the government's ordering, the federal government has ordered in several cases that the locals not tell anybody what they're doing. This is... Again, if we had a Congress that actually did its job, I would hope some of this stuff would change.
Can we get that kid with the spoons on his eyes again? I'm getting depressed. And I got to read a commercial.
Right. Yeah, we need something more happy.
This is the most depressing tweet ever. So I want to know more about HopeX. I love the name. Hackers on Planet Earth equals Hope. It sounds like it was a great conference. So maybe you can tell us a little bit more about it, Dan, when we come back. How about that? Our show today brought to you by Audible.com. We're going to talk a little later on about Amazon's new Kindle Unlimited. That's nice, but I tell you what, I like to listen to books. Hint, hint, Amazon. Right now, I'm a huge fan of Audible.com. You know that. I have been since the turn of the century. I think I got my Audible account in 2001, and I've got over 500 books in my Audible library. It's one of the neat things about Audible is that once you buy a book on Audible.com, it's yours forever. It's in your bookshelf. You can go back and listen to it. 150,000 titles. They've got fiction, nonfiction. They've got wonderful thrillers. Mark Rusinovich's Rogue Code. In fact, the trilogy, the Jeff Aiken trilogy, is all on Audible. Wonderfully read by Johnny Heller. If you like... This is kind of cyber. This is a new style of fiction, kind of a cyber thriller. Zero Day, I think, was the first one. Trojan Horse, and now the latest just came out, Rogue Code. I'm going to tell you how you can get two books free. So that's why I mention Audible and maybe mention a few titles. There's so many great choices. This is one I keep getting recommended. I don't know why Audible thinks I want to read The Art of Fermentation. What could... An in-depth exploration. Actually, I can't wait. I do want to read this book because bread making, beer making, a lot of what we do, kimchi making involves fermentation.
Just be careful it doesn't become rancid, right?
Yeah, well, that's right. We're stewing, but we don't want to rancid. Kids' books, you bet. Now, one of the things that's nice about...
I'm going to get you in trouble for your ad.
You already are, I tell you. No. No rancidity here, just pure fermentation. One of the great things about Audible is they have books for young adults and children, too. You might say, well, I like to read my kids. Of course you do. But, you know, one of the studies have shown that kids who listen to audiobooks read faster, read earlier. They want to pick up the books and look at them. How about The Wind in the Willows, read by Shelley Frazier, the classic Kenneth Graham book? Oh, what a great book that was. Little Women, Treasure Island, read by Alfred Molina, the great actor Alfred Molina. Audible has the best books, but also the best readers. They bring these books to life. And I think more than any movie, more than any play, more than certainly reading a novel, listening to a novel, there's something that happens. It just comes alive in your brain. And sometimes I'll go see a movie that I've listened to on Audible and I'll say, I already saw this. And actually it was better. It was better in my brain. Visit audible.com. Pick a couple of books. There are many to choose from. The latest Stephen King, Mr. Mercedes, is out. I finished some months ago Michael Lewis's Flash Boys. That's fascinating. I read a lot of nonfiction and technology fiction on audible.com. Go to audible.com/twit2. You'll be signing up for the Platinum account. That'll give you two credits a month. Most books are one credit. Plus the Daily Digest of the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. You can cancel anytime in the first 30 days. Pay nothing, but those books will be yours to keep. Before you see Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, listen to the official movie novelization. Actually, you know, there are books, there are movies like MASH, which started as books and became movies. And I got to tell you, if you haven't read the book MASH, and I bet you most of you haven't, it's great. If you love the movie, you'd love the book. Hot Lips Houlihan, Trapper John, they're all in there. Audible.com/twit2. Get your two books absolutely free. You will thank me later, I promise you. At the gym, in the car, if you've got a commute, walking the dog, doing the dishes, I listen to Audible all the time. Audible.com/twit2. Actually, Lisa and I, it was kind of fun, listened to a book together. We listened to The Martian together. Actually, Brian Brushwood inspired that. And it was so much fun. And we, you know, we'd say, okay, we're going to listen now. When we were driving in Hawaii, we would listen. It was so much fun. So it's something you can do with a friend, too. Audible.com/twit2. We thank them for their support of This Week in Tech. Dan Gilmore is here. Writes for The Guardian, professor at the Cronkite School at Arizona State University, where he teaches kids entrepreneurship and how to think for themselves, damn it. DanGilmore.com, GILLMOR.com. And you're at Dan Gilmore on the Twitter, right?
That's right.
Also from Stratechery, Ben Thompson, great analyst. You worked, I didn't realize you worked at Automattic. I guess you mentioned that last time you were on. What did you do at Automattic?
I was working on growth stuff and growth and marketing type stuff. So I know enough programming to work there, which is a prerequisite, but mostly working on WordPress.com specifically, helping us get more users, retain the users that we had. So
I love Matt Mullenweg, the creator of WordPress, and I think it's what he's done with Automattic is smart because they've got the kind of nonprofit open source WordPress, but they also have the commercial side, and which supports development. And it's a great way to keep something like that alive and vital and fluid.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with WordPress, there's a huge community, which supports the .org a lot as well. So, I just say that because I know that Matt always hates it when it comes across that .com does everything. But it is a real honor to work there, and obviously, my business is built on WordPress, and lots of people's are. So it's really an amazing product.
I still use WordPress for my personal blog.
I use it for several. I admire Matt and those people a great deal.
Yeah, they've
walked the talk in ways that almost no one else has done.
Well, and especially being in journalism, I mean the impact of blogging generally, and the fact that there are no more gatekeepers when it comes to publishing content. I mean that more than anything. I mean, along with all the infrastructural issues with journalism and being digital and all that sort of stuff, but that, along with that, has had such a huge impact and really changed what it means to be published, to be out there. It's now easy to be published, and that changed it for me. That's for sure.
Well, and on that note, maybe I'll mention that the Blogger Conference is coming up in San Jose. We've got some people here in the studio audience who are here for Blogger, BLOGGER14. Blogger always was about women bloggers, right? But bloggers in general, and it really is a great organization. So, when is the conference this week? How exciting!
It's their 10th anniversary, and they're amazing people. Lisa and her team—they've really done a great job.
Yeah, really. Lisa Camahort Page and their team have really helped foster not only bloggers, but we, you know, as we always say, we pay a lot of lip service to getting women into technology. They've really done it, and without being demeaning in any way. I hope that's not demeaning to say that. But we don't want it to be a boys' club. That's a bad thing. Amazon has decided it's going to do a Netflix for books, $10 a month. It's called Kindle Unlimited, and it is launching. I've seen it on the front page of Amazon. I briefly considered it, and then I saw that none of the books I wanted to read were part of it. I mean, I like the idea, but it's not the entire Amazon bookstore, and I'm sure as long as publishers have anything to do with it, it won't be. What do you think? The Verge says Amazon's Netflix for books might be doomed before it started. is this a good idea, bad idea? It's not the first Netflix for books. Oyster Books has been doing this for 6 months or so, maybe a year.
You know, first I have to do a disclosure. I own a small amount of Amazon stock, but I have to agree with you. I'm not going to pay for this. Yeah. It's too expensive for not enough. I suspect, and I have absolutely no knowledge or further insight into what they're doing internally, but I've got to believe they're going to end up with tiers of service like other companies, and that maybe it'll be, you know, $3 or something for a part of the catalog.
And, right.
And onwards. So, you know, if you want to read, all self-published books, it'll be a lot cheaper than
How Netflix handled that, right?
But they don't want to be part of it yet. And that's it's very unclear, by the way, as an author, I have to tell you, it's very unclear to me whether this is a good deal for me as an author. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's several problems why, one, this is interesting, and two, why I don't think it's, this particular one is going to work. First off, for Amazon specifically, I mean, it doesn't seem, it's probably not the best idea to be raking over the publishers and trying to extract every last penny from their pocket, even while you need their support to launch a new kind of service. There's perhaps as part of these notorious negotiations that Amazon's undergoing with the publishers to get the support. But regardless, that you need publisher support to do this. And right now they don't have it, and I don't think it's compelling for that reason. Two, though, I think this is a very interesting way where they're actually, the publishers ought to figure out someone or among themselves a way to do this, because I think it is very compelling to have a Kindle alternative. Like, a big problem is because they insist on DRM, the publishers do, that locks everyone into Kindle. And there's no real alternative, and that's why they're kind of behind the eight ball in these negotiations. And it would be very interesting to see if there could be a real alternative to Amazon that would kind of break the Kindle's kind of power over ebooks by using this model as an alternative to the Kindle model. The problem, though, from the publisher perspective, is there's a few whales in the book. When I was at Microsoft, I worked on the publishing category for the Windows 8 store, and one thing you learn about the book industry is it's very much a whale sort of industry. There are few people that buy a ton of books.
Is that true?
I always thought
when you said whale, I thought, oh, you're talking about Daniel Steele. You're talking about either big publishers or big authors, but you're talking about big readers.
Yeah, no, for sure. I worked on the Kindle app for Windows 8, and what was a big thing was you had to test consistently for people that had like over 10,000 titles in their library. Like, it was insane. And again, it wasn't very many people, but there are a few people that buy multiple books a week. And these
really?
People
do they read them or what?
Yeah, no, these voracious readers that just are reading constantly, and they support a lot of the industry. And so in particularly in reading, where it's a smaller market than it is for music, for example, where everyone listens to music, a lot fewer people read books, and that makes this much more fraught, because if those people move to the subscription model, you've just given up a whole lot of revenue, and it's not clear you're going to make it up on the other side.
Yeah.
I have a really good Netflix for books. It's called My Public Library.
Good point.
I'm very happy with it.
Fortunately, most of the whales don't go to the public library.
No, because they want what they want right away.
They want to own it. I look at this and Oyster Books, and it's actually very much the same list. Amazon's claiming 600,000 titles, Oyster Books 500,000. But if you look at the titles on one, it's very similar to the titles on another. Both of them have the old but still probably valuable Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. The big bestsellers, I was looking, you know, the thing that I use as the litmus test is a book I'm reading right now by Donna Tartt, a Pulitzer Prize winning book called The Goldfinch. Neither store has that, and that would be frustrating. If you wanted to read the current bestsellers, you wouldn't find it on either store. So in that case, in that respect, it's very much like Netflix streaming or Amazon Prime movies. It's got movies, it's got books, just not the ones you want to watch or read. I do think it could end all end in tears, as Scotland Calling said, in the sense that maybe if you pay $5 more, you'd get more. But I wonder, I do worry about authors. Do you think Amazon really wants to be basically be the publisher? They've already offered, for instance, and I don't think any of the publishers took them up on it. They said, look, if we can't get a book from you, can we just print it and send it to our customer? A print-on-demand service for publishers. I don't know how they're taking to that. Isn't Amazon want to get the publishers out of the business entirely?
No, I think Amazon sees, and they've actually been very vocal about this, they see the publishers as being dinosaurs and kind of something of a past era that doesn't need to exist anymore, or relic of a past era. And there's reasons to be, you know, to be sympathetic to that. I think I mentioned briefly the whole upheaval in publishing that blogs have done. Well, you could argue there's no reason ebooks shouldn't have a similar effect. You know, I think that's where you get a lot of interesting questions around DRM, around all the sort of issues that go into digital. It's you can see Amazon's point in a way. Then again, Dan might have a different view. I'm not a published author.
Yeah, how do authors feel about that, Dan?
It depends what author you talk to. The ones who are the big selling ones, they're going to stick with what works for them very well, which is the traditional model.
Right.
But the economics of it have stopped making sense for all kinds of reasons, and the whole idea that we should all, as authors, be forced through this orifice of five big publishing companies that increasingly are indifferent to the finding of excellence as opposed to things that will sell. I'm just ready for some big changes, and the fact that Amazon took such a giant market share has a lot more to do with the publishing industry letting it happen without having any counter response at all, and certainly fighting it every step of the way on one hand and then working with it on another.
Right. They have the same kind of schizophrenic response the music industry had.
Yeah. Yeah, and the production costs, are, you know, there's different costs in publishing than in music, but it's there's some similarities, and I'm not a typical author, partly because I put my work out under Creative Commons licenses so that people can download them anyway. But that, and by the way, that does not hurt sales, which people think is counterintuitive, but it's not. There's a whole new ecosystem emerging that we're still just getting glimmerings of. I think my hope is that Amazon will not dominate it as much as they've dominated so far, because that's just not healthy.
Yeah. Jerry Pournelle loves Amazon and loves ebooks. But he's an author who has a vast back catalog.
Yeah.
And for him, he's a long tail author, I guess. For him, something like Amazon is a boon, because no bookstore is going to carry all of Jerry's books. Actually, they might.
It's a gatekeeper thing, though, too. I mean, if you're already a published author, you're already in the club.
Right.
So, of course, you'd love to see the club continue. I mean, it's the same thing. Like I, once upon a time, I wanted to be like a columnist for the New York Times, right? That was my...
That was the club.
But, like, I didn't want to be put in my, you know, no offense to the journalists in the room, but I don't want to put in my years of being, you know, covering City Hall and covering
kid, but
school
you got
meetings stuff like that. No, right. I mean, and but what's so marvelous about the web and about blogs and all this sort of stuff is I don't need to ask permission. I can start something up and nothing is granted to me. I need to earn an audience. I need to earn people trusting me, and then not just to read, but then to also like give me my, I don't have to ask anyone permission to do it. And that's what's potentially exciting about ebooks as well, is if we can get to an area where an author can sell himself. And yes, authors, some authors who are happy with the current system, of course they don't want to do that because they don't want to do the work. Just like a lot of journalists don't want to do all the social media stuff because they just want to do their work, but that's not the world anymore.
But you, you don't need permission to write something. Increasingly, though, you need access to the new form of distribution, which is not manufacturing and putting in trucks, but rather having people know it's there.
That's for sure, which is much harder.
Harder and harder to do. And that's one issue, and I worry a lot about that in the net neutrality ballpark. But the thing that really is poisonous right now, I think, in publishing when it comes to ebooks is the incompatibility by design of all the formats, and the fact that these guys all want to, or at least they give the appearance of all wanting to own the ecosystem for themselves. And there's resonance there with some of this control stuff that we're seeing in other parts of the tech and communications ecosystems, and we really need to fix this.
No, well, that's the thing with the publishers, right? Is the publishers have given Amazon the hammer with which they're being hit by insisting on DRM. Like if there were no DRM for eBooks, Amazon would have a whole lot. They would still have the actual hardcover, you know, book power because they're such a huge distributor. But they would have, you know, one of their arms tied behind their back, as it were, which is.
But it's more than just DRM.
I'm mixing metaphors like a madman.
It's not just DRM. It's the part of it's the file format that sometimes are well, you know, from Microsoft that are difficult to translate. But there's a lot of books you can buy on Amazon Kindle now that are not DRM, but you know you can't read
they're
that
Mobi,
file
so you have
in anything else.
Yeah.
So. If we had some standard formats that we do have a few standards. The problem is they're not great yet at working in a variety of devices. And if the big publishers were smart, they would be doing, they'd get together to do their own things, but also continue to work with Amazon.
Someday when we have more time, Dan, Ben, I'll ask you about the Mobi format, because obviously you know the insides and outs pretty well, having written Kindle
a bit,
reader.
But I think Dan's point is well taken.
Yeah,
and
there's no standard,
right? And even if you could totally see Amazon following the Microsoft route, right? Where Office documents are now an open standard; they're certified as such, but no one can actually implement them the way that
is EPUB the way it should be. Is that the standard we should all be adhering to? Is that good enough?
The new one's pretty. It's getting better from my. And
that's the open ebook standard, right?
There's some better and better tools for creating. Electronic documents. I'm optimistic about this. I really think it's going to come together.
I have in my hands a box which could have contained a Fire phone, but doesn't. This at the end of the week, Amazon's first phone will come out. Something Amazon been working on for years, was rumored to be working on for years. In fact, that rumor is true. The Fire phone. I presume neither of you have seen one, nor have I, because while I did get a box, it was empty.
Adventures in packaging.
Yeah. Weird, isn't that? I wonder, is this just a Me Too? Is this, Fire TV, just something that Amazon's keeping, it's a placeholder to keep Amazon in the game, or is this a game changer?
Well, I don't think anyone's going to say it's a game changer.
No, it's just another phone, right?
I think the charitable description of it is it's a way to get more out of Prime buyers. is for Amazon's fans. And the other thing is that it's an experiment and they're figuring it out until they can, you know, innovate in more interesting ways, particularly when it comes to pricing and things like that. The problem that I have is actually very similar to the Microsoft one in that I think it's problematic for Amazon from an incentive perspective. The last thing they need to do is worry about supporting a device ecosystem that has a fraction of the market when they need, when their bread and butter needs to be killer on all the platforms. Like Firefly?
Firefly.
That's
kind of cool. You have a button on the side of the phone. You push it. It'll scan, take a picture of whatever you're looking at and give you information about it, whether it's a Wikipedia article or how to buy it cheaper on Amazon.
It is cool, and they're never going to get a button on an iPhone, but
no.
they do have similar capability in the iOS app now, but that needs to be there on day one. Like, that's more important for the company, in my opinion.
We call it the showrooming button, so you can go into Best Buy, get the lowdown on a product, take a picture of it, and go get it on Amazon.
I might add that if they provide that service for my current phone, I might add it, but would I buy the Fire phone? No. I couldn't imagine buying that at this point.
I think it's a shame in a way. I mean, they're entering such a mature market. I do think Firefly's cool. I think Mayday's cool. They're going to add the button where you get instant help, the one that they have on their Fire tablets. And within 15 seconds, some nice person comes on and you can ask her to marry you, and it's great. That's innovative.
Except for like the one time you get the Comcast rep who pops on to Mayday.
That would be bad. I can see you, and you're not using the number one ebook service in America. We're going to take a break. A couple of final stories. Ben Thompson's here from Stratechery, stratechery.com. Dan Gilmore from dangilmore.com. Our show today brought to you by squarespace.com. It's an amazing platform. It does all the hosting, but also the software. If you're going to start your blog, I want you to look at this. All the software is so tightly integrated to the hosting that you get a very responsive site. You cannot bring a Squarespace site down, no matter how many millions of people visit all at the same time. The software is state-of-the-art, so you're going to get, without knowing any code, without knowing CSS or JavaScript or HTML, you're going to get any one of these 25 templates, something that you can completely customize, make your own. It's mobile responsive. That means it's going to look great on any size screen. You don't have a separate mobile site. It's just your site looks great on any size screen, from iPhone to a 30-inch display. Every site, every template has commerce built in, even at $8 a month. Now, the $8 a month plan, which is their basic plan, allows you to take a donation, which would be very handy for your new blog, or if you're a nonprofit, take charity donations. You could do a fundraiser for a school or a nonprofit on a Squarespace site. In fact, you get this site for free for 2 weeks. So, you know, if you got a, you know what a lot of people do as a wedding gift or as a baby gift is they create a Squarespace site. When you register for a year, you get the domain name at $8 a month. It's very affordable. Design a beautiful site for the new baby, and then you give that to the new parents. Say, I've registered your child's name on the internet, so we'll have that forever. And here's that beautiful baby site for you. There's so much you could do with Squarespace. Try it today. Just go to squarespace.com, click the Get Started button. You don't have to give them a credit card or any personal information. You've got 2 weeks to use it. If you decide to buy, all I ask is you use our offer code TWIT. You'll get 10% off. Just as a way to let them know you heard about it on TWIT and a way for you to save a little bit of money. For nonprofits, for blogs, for photo. I mean, this is really state-of-the-art gorgeous. And by the way, the best support in the world, 24/7 from their offices in New York City. They've got a Squarespace, newly redesigned Squarespace help site. So for articles, video, workshops, webinars, everything you could want. So you're never at a loss. And if you are a developer, if you know JavaScript, HTML, CSS, they have a very nice developer platform too, which means you could actually have a business, a consulting business, setting up Squarespace sites for people. Squarespace.com. They take care of the hosting. They take care of the software. They give you a beautiful site. Use the offer code TWIT and you'll get 10% off. But you don't have to worry about that. Just try it free. No credit card needed at squarespace.com. Just press the Get Started button. Speaking of Netflix, hey, good news. Netflix now has a private surfing button. So I can watch my Little Pony videos and not get busted. You know, it's been a problem because you watch one My Little Pony movie, and that's all they recommend now. It's kind of embarrassing. Actually, it was only a matter of time. I think it's kind of a good idea. They won't necessarily be on your Netflix account right now. They're rolling it out, testing it. But a private viewing mode on Netflix. Everybody wants a little privacy. Yes, I'm a brony.
I think there's lots of ways you could take this this piece of news, but I think it is for anything that depends on a recommendation algorithm. I think this is particularly welcome. Although, perhaps there's some funny thing about recommendation algorithms. How they tend to know you, what you say you're interested in tends to be very different from what you're actually interested in.
It goes way back to TiVo. Remember the thumbs up, thumbs down in the article? TiVo thinks I'm gay. And it kept, because I have the modern, TiVo Romeo Pro or whatever it is. And it records. It's such a big hard drive. It records like daily, every day, 20 new shows based on what it thinks you want. I actually had to take the Spanish language channels off the channel guide because it kept recording shows in Spanish for me for some reason. It was like, I don't understand. So you're right. Recommendation engines. It's the dancing. I shouldn't dance in front of my Xbox One. It's sending that information back.
I got to ask, who is this private from? Clearly Netflix knows what you're watching anyway, right? And is this private from your spouse and kids or what? I wasn't clear on what that gets you.
That's a very good point. I guess it's private from the recommendation engine, and that's that.
Well, that has value.
It doesn't go in your log, so you're right. It's mostly, you're right. It's not private from Netflix. It's not private from the NSA. It's only private from your wife. That's who it's private from.
It's an interesting point to think about, the cheapening of the word private. Like, what does private mean?
Right.
Because there's lots of things. I think Chrome has a private browsing mode, and we certainly know that nothing Google related will ever be private.
Right.
If I
go into incognito mode, that it's sending data back to Google anyway?
Of course it is.
Oh.
They say it is. They don't promise anything except that it won't show up in the history.
So really private means private from your spouse. In every case.
I think it won't record any history. It won't, I don't know if it'll save cookies. I mean, sort of basic privacy in the instance in the browser from someone with access to your computer. But I don't think anything more than that.
Right. Rupert Murdoch put Time Warner in play. I think he just does it for fun. Bid $80 billion on Wednesday to buy Time Warner, the content side of Time Warner. He wasn't bidding for the cable company. Time Warner seems to have rebuffed that, but now that has put them in play with a lot of other companies, including ESPN, Warner Brothers.
It was Time Warner just spun off Time, which is all the print publications, which Murdoch just also did something as well.
News, nobody wants to be in print anymore.
Off from
if you're smart, you're not buying magazines these days,
right? But I think you mentioned ESPN. I think what's interesting about this is Time Warner has a decent sports portfolio,
yeah.
And that's something that 20th Century Fox is very interested in developing. It started Fox Sports One. It's not doing very well, and I suspect that has a lot to do with it. If you look at ESPN's, ESPN drives 50% of Disney's profits. I mean, it's incredibly lucrative, and very resistant to a lot of the quote unquote disruptive things when it comes to television because it's live. It commands a big premium. It's that whole arena is certainly interesting for that reason.
I should say Warner Brothers did not put in a bid to buy Time Warner. That would be weird since they are owned by Time Warner.
Yeah.
That was I misstated. Dell is accepting Bitcoin for online purchases. This is just publicity, right? Because they immediately cash it in for American dollars. Or is there something here? Is there something going on? You can buy your Alienware gaming machine with your Bitcoin.
Yeah, I mean, I'm aiming to support Bitcoin, you know, as soon as I can on
really?
My blog. Why not?
We take Bitcoin donations. What? I have 7.6 Bitcoins right now, thanks to our listening audience. Who gives?
Well, I would do the same thing where it converts instantly to cash. I mean, if people want to pay in it, by all means. I think probably the more interesting Bitcoin news is getting into things like 51% attacks and stuff, or potential and things along those natures. But as far as I think companies supporting it, exactly right. I think it's mostly it's good PR. They get an article written about them,
right?
And it's
they immediately turn it into dollars, right?
But I don't think it's just PR. I think I think that's probably a large part of it. But it's really worth it for these companies to be learning what they can about the new forms of currency that are coming along. And more than that, the Bitcoin story, I'm increasingly convinced, is not about currency, but about the protocols. And what they're doing is pretty stunning. When you look deeper into what Bitcoin means, and I'm saying this without sufficient depth on it. I'm studying this hard now, and I've become convinced that Bitcoin is a huge thing, not so much because of the currency, but because of the architecture. I think this is profound and important.
I agree. I completely agree. And it is worth noting, by the way, that from Dell's perspective, I mean, the lowered fees make a huge difference. I mean, I've paid enough in credit card fees to appreciate
there is a
financial benefit to this as well.
What does Coinbase take? Because basically what happens is, I think the transaction goes through Coinbase. They turn it into U.S. dollars immediately. But you're saying they take less than a credit card company would?
Oh, yes, significantly less. Yeah. I mean, I think obviously Bitcoin theoretically could be free. Usually to get it processed in a timely way, you could pay a very small fee. But relative to a credit card, which is a few percent, it's practically zero.
Who's your carrier, Ben? Because you're slowly fading into the sunset.
I am in Madison, so it's Charter Cable.
Oh, yeah. Charter, huh? Oh, yeah. I think this would be a good time to wrap it up. I'm just looking to see if there's any other, you know, really huge story. I guess there was one question I had for you, Dan Gilmore. Did Newsweek ever recant its cover story about discovering the creator of Bitcoin hiding in plain sight in Los Angeles? I think everybody pretty much agrees that was not Satoshi Nakamoto they found.
Great question. I have no idea.
They just hope nobody brings it up again.
Yeah.
You should ask every week.
Yeah. Hey, Newsweek, is it still Satoshi? Is that still Satoshi? Is it?
Well, I think it is Satoshi Nakamoto.
Just it's not Satoshi Nakamoto. We never said it was the Satoshi Nakamoto, just some guy named Satoshi Nakamoto. I mean, this was when Newsweek in March went back to the newsstands with they had stopped publishing paper issues. Their first paper edition in a long time. They had a cover story, the face behind Bitcoin. Leah McGrath Goodman wrote the story, said she has sources. Newsweek said, we stand by this story. And at this point, it's pretty obvious. Yeah, they got it wrong, completely wrong. But nobody's just going to mention it. It's just, that's it. We don't
care. I think the
March is so off the news cycle now, we don't care anymore.
Well, it's that Newsweek isn't particularly important anymore.
I think it means you can say anything you want, and if you could survive a few months, you go unscathed.
Let's see where it is in Google.
search for Newsweek and Satoshi Nakamoto. Dan Gilmore, there are some lucky students at Arizona State University. He's a professor at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism there, and entrepreneurship and modern creative thinking and all of that jazz, basket weaving. I don't know what you teach there, but they're lucky to have you. It's nice to have you. Are you still living in the Bay Area, or have you moved down there?
No, we still live in the Bay Area. I'm part-time on the faculty there, and I go down there physically 1 week a month.
Awesome. Like I said, it's nice to have professors who actually come from the real world. So they're very fortunate to have you. It's also great to have you. Ben Thompson, one of the best analysts out there. His blog is free to read, Stratechery, but he also has a paid newsletter, and you can find out more at the website, Stratechery. And how's the podcast going? Last time we had you on, you just launched it. Is it going well?
It's going very well. With James Allworth, a fellow from Harvard. Oh, he was at Harvard. He's worked with Clay Christensen, now works for a startup in the Valley.
Oh, I love Clay Christensen. We've had him on Triangulation. Clay's really fascinating fella. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we spent a lot of time talking about more the impact of tech on society, also some of the theoretical stuff. We spent quite a bit of time the last few episodes, actually. You know, there's all that debate about disruption, and I agree in parts. I'm more of a skeptic. James is probably more of a defender. So I think if you're interested in any sort of that business theory sort of stuff or tech and society, definitely check it out. It's Exponent, Exponent.fm.
Exponent.fm, or you can get to it from the Stratechery site. Thank you so much, Ben. Thank you, Dan. Thank you all for watching. We do Twit every Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time, 2200 UTC. Love it if you watch live. We'll see you in the chat room. It's great to get your feedback and your input as we go through the show. You can also visit us in studio, big studio audience today. It's great to have you all. Just email. You don't have to, but it's nice if you email tickets at twit.tv. We'll make sure to have a chair out for you. And, you know, free food, no alcohol, nothing like that. Maybe a balloon on your way out. I think we have the new Twit pens are here. You'll each and every one of you get a pen. Hey, don't forget, we're having a little bit of a party. This is our third year in the Brick House. We moved in on July 24th, 2011. We're going to have a little open house coming Wednesday, the 23rd, if you'd like to come by. There will be cake. If you stick around, we put out a little cot in the basement for you. You can stay. And you'll get cake. So please come by anytime on Wednesday. Thanks to Chad Johnson, who does such a... Oh, I got more to talk about. That's thanks to Chad Johnson. I was going to give you a plug, Chad.
Thanks. Sorry. I'm
thanks to Chad Johnson, who produces the show, puts together the rundown, books the guests. He is running the board right now. He does everything to make this show happen, and I really appreciate it. I thought just the other day, I was thinking, thank goodness I've got Chad on this show.
Oh, thanks, man. I can't get my hair in.
He also pays attention to the fact that we are doing a vote right now on our next Twitch shirt. I think we're going to open it. Lisa says we're going to open a regular store, but we like to do a one-off thing every month where you can get the shirt, but only for 30 days. We've got four designs we purchased from 99 Designs, and what we'd like you to do is to visit those designs. Pick the one you like the best, and then vote for it. And we're going to have the vote go on for about a week. What is the address for the straw poll?
Currently,
actually, just go to inside.twit.tv. That's our blog. That's where you'll see the designs, and then there's a link there. We want you to see the designs before you vote. Obviously, don't show
the results.
Don't show the results.
Wait,
Lisa.
I'm getting conflicted information here.
Show the results.
Here.
Lisa's the boss. Show the results.
Okay.
So far. You can change. Oh, see, it's very close. Right now, it's the brick wall that's winning. But boy, the spotlight's really close. Steampunk kind of taking up the end there.
Sorry. Over 1,400 votes are in currently.
But that's not the end of the game. But we're going to vote all week long. So keep your votes coming in. Inside.twit.tv, that's a Squarespace site. So go ahead. Everybody go there all at the same time. Don't all vote at the same time. That is not a Squarespace site.
Straw poll is pretty good. Is it good?
Because we used to be able to bring it down. Has Dan got it on a hot server?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're up to, let's look at how many straw polls.
There's quite a few.
Yeah. There's quite over a few. 2 million now.
That's awesome.
Straw polls.
Dan Dirks, who designed that originally for...
for NSFW.
For NSFW.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now over 2 million straw polls created.
Over 2 million straw polls served.
Right.
Is there any... Oh, let's see. You know, this is going to be a big week for Twit because there's a lot of results coming in, the Microsoft quarterly results. Let's see. I think Mike Elgin has a rundown.
Coming up this week, another big week for earnings. Netflix reports financial results on Monday, July 21st. Apple, Microsoft, and Verizon on Tuesday. Facebook and Qualcomm get their turn Wednesday. And on Friday, July 25th, Amazon's Fire Phone ships at last from AT&T only.
I hope your box
is coming up this week. Back to you, Leo.
Thank you, Mike Elgin, TNT, Monday through Friday, your daily dose of tech news in the morning at 10 a.m. Pacific. That's 1 p.m. Eastern, 1700 UTC. If you want to find out what's happening, that's the show to watch. Or Tech News Tonight, which is a 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern. And I can't even do the math on UTC. It's 2300 UTC. Thanks for joining us. Hey, we'll see you next time. If you can't be here live, you can always get the show on our website, twit.tv, wherever podcasts are aggregated, a Stitcher, iTunes, Xbox Music, and of course, our great Twit apps, thanks to our third-party developers. Another Twit is in the can. Take care.